Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. I'm so excited to have this next guest on the podcast. I met Dr. Aaron Babb 3 years ago. He walked into an integrative clinic I was at in Minneapolis answering a Craigslist post to rent space and possibly become part of our team. We started a conversation with another colleague, and 4 hours later, as if no time had passed, we all realized an amazing connection had just occurred. And personally, I knew that I had encountered a very special individual. Dr. Aaron and I developed a pretty immediate professional relationship and a friendship. He had a real interest in holistic care and a desire to bridge the imaginary divide across our fields of care. It has been a goal of mine for 20 years to collaborate with an MD and to create a fully integrative experience for people I work with. And it was a thrill to find out he felt the same way. We met regularly for the better part of the next year to talk about our personal projects and began to see more and more that our thinking about the future of care was very much aligned. I was curious to learn more from his experience in health technology as I had begun exploring ways to organize my health networks in two U.S. cities from frequent trips between Minneapolis and New York. Our meetings over time grew to be about how to best use technology to improve care, deliver better referrals, and build better relationships and resource networks. What impresses me still about Dr. Aaron is his persistence in the face of incredible obstacles. He's here to tell his story, one that I think many will be able to relate to because it is not just the story of a medical professional. It is about having a childhood dream and then learning that the reality of that dream is not all that you had hoped for. It is also the story of failing fast in front of family and friends and colleagues, but never losing sight of your bigger vision for yourself. He came down from Burney, California to Oakland to meet with me for a conversation while I was in the Bay Area vacationing with my family. He keeps a low profile, as he explains at the start here, but remember his name. For the sake of healthcare in this country, I, for one, want to make sure that his ideas get out there. Here's my conversation with the one and only Dr. Aaron Babb.
There's very little actually about me on the internet, unless you're like on LinkedIn and can kind of put a few things together.
Yeah.
And so people see, oh, you know, orthopedics, like, why are you here? Or that sort of thing. And and then as they get to know me, because they come in and see me more often, I tell them a little bit more stuff. Or most people don't even know that I was like trying to do tech stuff. And so it's interesting.
And most people wouldn't care.
Yeah. Or most people wouldn't really like understand, I think, up there. Necessarily, you know, because like, because it's actually a very rural area. It's very,
what's the name of the town?
So it's called Burney.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's right outside of Redding. So it's in Northern California. So I used to think, well, actually before I moved out here, I used to think California was San Francisco, LA, and San Francisco, right? The right. State is huge.
Yeah.
Like huge.
Yeah.
I also think that
as I just experienced, since I just went from LA to Joshua Tree to Bakersfield.
Oh.
So Bakersfield is like an oil town.
Yeah.
And I went to pick up food one night and it took forever. And I ended up talking to this guy who had like moved to Bakersfield from Fresno or someplace.
And Fresno's another interesting one.
And, you know, just like just hearing the stories of it. And he said like a few years ago, like when oil prices dropped, the town died for a while. No one had any money. That the restaurant he was working in was just like he had started his own restaurant. It closed, so he was working for this restaurant now.
Totally. Just like probably what's happening in North Dakota, right?
Yeah, and then going into like Yosemite area from there, and like on the way there, all the like fruit and vegetable growers, all those groves that you go through on the way through there, and then leaving there, you end up in like these cowboy towns. I mean, it's just
totally.
It's just huge. It's so vast and so many different climate zones within, you know, an hour's time. I mean, we were like 45 minutes outside of Oakland, and I was like, this is,
yeah.
I had no idea what was even out here.
Yep, exactly. And you can drive like 4 hours and not get anywhere, especially. So anyway, so I used to think that this was Northern California. This is not Northern California. Like once you get to like Redding and above, it's totally different. Like mountainous, like.
So how far is Redding from here?
Like four.
From Oakland.
From Oakland, it's about 3 hours, 3.5. And then Burney is another hour up into the mountains, over the mountain. So it's actually in the Intermountain Range. That's what they call it. So it's actually like between like all these mountains. So you have to get over like the like mountain pass. So the first time when I went there, it was like right after Christmas because I started like right into end of December, and going over the mountain, I couldn't even see the road. Like, and all these signs were like, caution, you need like chains on your car, or you need like winter tires and stuff. And I was like, oh shit. But luckily I made it. It was crazy.
So, and then how far are you from the Oregon
So border? It's actually like quite a bit. Let's see. I wonder how far it would take. Probably another 3 hours or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, as the crow flies, you're not that far away, but just because of the mountains.
Yes, exactly. And it's like slow and it's twisty and yeah, it's crazy. So anyway, so this, a lot of these towns were, are mill towns, you know, like forestry towns. A lot of people work in the forestry department, and then when they close, like, I mean, the other thing that we could talk about, man, which is really interesting and crazy, we should talk about this later at some point, but is the number of people that I see who are on like disability, the number of people who are on like, you know, state Medicaid or like welfare, all that kind of stuff, you know, it's like crazy compared to like where I'm from and the, and like what, and when you ask people like why they're on disability, cause like these other providers, when I was there, I'm like inheriting all these like patients and stuff because they get so much turnover because these places are so remote and so rural, you know, and like mostly like nurse practitioners and PAs or like doctors who come for a little bit and then like leave. Right. So I've like, there's a ton of turnover like before I got there. So I'm inheriting all these patients and people who have been on like long-term disability for like not like, like that big of deal stuff, kind of like arthritis and like, or like depression, you know what I mean? And like,
and how do they get,
because basically to get on disability, you just need a doctor to sign your shit.
Okay.
Which is crazy. So I listened to this American Life podcast, I think, and they were doing a special on this count, like counties in Arkansas, and the like 75% of the counties are on now on federal disability.
Yeah.
Because all these companies shut down, so there's no more jobs.
Yeah.
So basically, they did this investigative work. They found like one doctor who basically was just writing people's disability stuff, and basically they tracked him down. He didn't want to talk, but he basically was saying, like, there's nothing else for these people. So I feel like,
oh wow. So it's the relationships that start to happen in these situations.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so this town is like super rural, and. But at the same time, 20 miles away in this hospital is called Fall River Mills, which is actually much more, like, it's super small still, but much more affluent.
Yeah.
So, like, Clint Eastwood has a house there and, like, some, like, other people because it's right on this beautiful river and stuff like that. So it's so interesting, like, these, like, smaller towns and that sort of thing, and, like, the only doctor there.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so how is this? So you've been there now for 5 months or something?
Something like that, yeah.
And you worked, just going back from when we met. You were at Dawson, Minnesota, border of South Dakota. What's different between these two rural hospitals?
Yeah. Well, I guess my job is quite a bit different because when I was working in Dawson, here, maybe I can just go back and like do the whole thing. So, as you know, like I grew up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I'm like a very proud South Dakotan.
Yeah.
I still actually, even though we're in Oakland, my car is in the garage and I still have South Dakota plates on it. Hopefully no one from the State Department like or whatever. But I still have my South Dakota driver's license, my South Dakota like, license plate. Even though I went to Minnesota for college and went to St. John's University,
where we also connect.
I know, is that crazy? And I guess my story along the way is pretty interesting. I've when I was in high school, I went and like shadowed a orthopedic surgeon because my dad was a businessman and like it was really pretty stressful when I was growing up,
And your mom was an art teacher?
Yeah. So like later on, she. She was like a stay-at-home mom, and then later on she ended up going back to get her like I think, went back to get her teaching degree, and then she was an art teacher. And she was an art teacher at, like, different schools, and then she ended up being an art teacher at this alternative high school. And so, which I think was super
awesome. And did you go there?
No, I went to this Catholic school. Okay. I actually went to Catholic school from kindergarten all the way through med school, kind of accidentally.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. I did K through 8 Catholic.
Yeah. Well, and college, too.
And then I went to college again.
Yeah. And then my medical school.
Although St. John's is like such a different, like, I mean, compared to my Catholic grade school situation, you know, where it was nuns, and I think the church had 3 priests. I was an altar boy. Were you an altar boy?
Oh, of course. Yes. Of course. It was almost like you had to be.
I think. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It was also maybe that was the beginning of like my performer thing. Like I wanted to be on stage.
Exactly. I don't think a lot of people realize that when you're like an altar boy, it's like kind of nerve wracking because it's like a production.
Yeah. You go into the back room with the robes.
I know, exactly. Yeah. It's like you put on this like costume and then you play the part.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you like fall asleep or space out when you're supposed to like ring the bells stuff. Oh man, that's super funny.
Yeah.
So I shadowed like an orthopedic surgeon when I was in high school because I really wanted to find, you know, like something with purpose or even that, like that young, I felt like I wanted to kind of like at least have a little control over my own destiny.
Yeah.
And because I played sports, I played hockey and football and track and golf, all sorts of stuff. It seemed like a very clear, kind of path for me to do like orthopedics and that sort of thing. So in high school, I kind of shadowed someone. I was like, all right, this is what I'm going to do. And during that part of my life, I was very like set a goal and not like waver in many ways. And I think, you know, looking back, maybe not the greatest thing, but it definitely helped me get through a lot of like adversity by knowing exactly what I wanted to do and nothing was going to kind of get in my way. So anyways, I graduated college a year early. I did like, you know, I graduated in 3 years because at O'Gorman, where I went to high school in Sioux Falls, you could take like AP classes and get some credits through like a community college. So I came into college with a few extra credits and I knew what I wanted to do, right? Yeah. So I was like, I'm just going to finish in 3 years. I took all these extra classes. I was like an RA, so I would just like study and do all my stuff on like when I had to like cover like the dorms and stuff. I was like an EMT too, so I would like be on call for both things. And like
at St. John's?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, and actually, I have some interesting stories about that too. Like, you know, finding people that I know like super sick and like, you know, intoxicated. You know, I've never been like a drinker or anything like that. And part of it, I think, was probably, you know, some of those stories, like finding, you know, like people like almost dead,
yeah,
you know, and having to send them like to the hospital and stuff like that. Yeah. And anyway, so
I had a roommate my freshman year at St. John's too, who was like quarter Native American. He had blonde hair. I went to high school with him.
Oh, wow.
But he would, you know, have like a drink and you could see like the sort of like the cartoon spinny eyes.
Yeah.
All of a sudden it was just like,
Change of personality.
Just, and then, you know, I don't know if it was necessarily that he would keep drinking or that he was just drunk so quickly.
Right.
And so he would end up in situations where he would like, you know, in St. Joe, the little town that we were, where we would go out, he would like get into the wrong car and get arrested by the local police because he was trying to figure out how to start this car and he had his keys and he didn't even realize what was going on. He drove the wrong way down Division back to the college, realized and went through the ditch and went up the ramp one night and he was like, that's it, I'm done.
Wow.
And came back and told me that was, and I don't know what he did after college, but he stopped drinking. He was a swimmer, stopped drinking, started driving bus on the weekends for his social.
Yeah.
There was the bus that went between the colleges.
Yeah. What a great idea.
Yeah. And that was it. Wow. But you know, it's the thing about, talk about like the drugs that, you know, we you and I have had many conversations about the, you know, your role in the being the drug dealer.
Oh yeah.
But alcohol causes so many problems for people. And
yeah,
we could go on and on about that, but that's something that I had such a like close view of in college that made me think like, okay, I don't know how this affects me or my family that much. I don't have anybody in my family, but I'm going to be careful.
Right. Yeah. And my, I think my grandpa was like an alcoholic, I guess, but he stopped drinking because the doctor scared the shit out of him when he was diagnosed with diabetes, which is awesome, I guess, yeah. Anyways. But yeah. I guess my dad stopped drinking when I was like young too. So there wasn't like alcohol around, and I kind of knew those stories, but no one really ever talked to me about it, you know, and like, you know, I like was drinking all sorts of stuff like early, like in like maybe middle school and like high school type of stuff, you know, but like very like calculated, you know, like that's kind of how I was.
As,
like
as a doctor
like,
would.
Yeah, like a calculated risk taker. And I feel like that in many ways, that's kind of what I've been. But of course, I've made some pretty bad calculations in the past. But yeah, and so like when I was in college, I kind of felt like, oh, I had a lot of those experience of like drinking and stuff. And so by knowing exactly what I wanted to do by being an orthopedic surgeon, I kind of probably missed out on a lot of stuff at St. John's because I was like looking forward always, you know. And I played football for the first 2 years, but mostly I think just because I was like good at football and that's kind of what you did.
Yeah.
And I played hockey in high school, which was way better. But to play hockey in Minnesota, you like had to come from a Minnesota school and be like super awesome. Yeah. Anyway, so I graduated like, you know, in 3 years and like applied for medical school and like really only applied to University of South Dakota where I was from because I was like dating someone at the time and I was like had this life plan. I was going to like go back there and all that. And I didn't get in the first year. You know, like after my like 3 years of college. So I went down there to talk to like the dean. I was kind of like, hey, man, like the hell? And he's like, well, the committee, you know, you're definitely bright enough to get in, but basically felt like, you know, you were just trying to go too fast and you don't have enough life experience and all that. And I was kind of like, you know, of course, like at first I was pissed, you know, but then later on I was like, wow, like I'm going to do all these different things and then I'm going to apply to, you know, bigger schools, like kind of fuck you type of stuff, you know? And it was of course the best thing that ever happened, you know, cause like in that year I worked as a nurse assistant, like a nursing assistant at the hospital at Avera for 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah. Interesting story, how it can all tie back together. Yeah. Right. And honestly, I think the reason why I did so well in medical school and the reason why I think I'm a pretty good doctor is that time period. Because I could see like the interactions of all the different layers of hierarchy, you know, in the hospital and like, you know, who answers to who and who you have to be nice to get things done. And like, and so like when I was in medical school, like being nice to the nurses and like kind of, you know, like not asking them to do anything and just being helpful. Like I saw as during those 6 months, like that makes a huge difference. If you can make someone like, you know, a colleague's life easier by helping them out without, you know, making a big deal about it, they'll really like respect you.
Yeah.
Whereas like a lot of the other like super smart people, I mean, I was really smart too. I mean, I finished like second in my class at Georgetown.
But those soft skills in any job situation, there's always politics.
Like always politics. And in the hospital, there's definitely politics. Yeah.
So you just started applying to colleges while you were working at Avera?
Yeah. So then in that year, I did those 6 months and that's when I met Walt, you know, or Dr. Carlson, you know, and I remember the first time we met, he was like, oh, I have this interesting case. Do you want to write it up? And I was like, sure, yeah. Kind of like, what does that even mean?
He was at Avera.
So he is at the Orthopedic Institute, which is actually a private group.
Okay.
There's a lot of politics in this story.
Yeah.
Like, I could get deep into the weird politics and stuff. But so they're actually on the Avera campus, but they're a private group.
Okay.
And they also own their own surgery center.
Yeah, yeah.
And they used to be very, like, friendly with Avera. But then as, like, the business of medicine has blown up and all sorts of, like, incentives have been misaligned and stuff, now they, like, hate each other. It's, yeah, it's super weird. Anyway, so he was like, oh, do you want to, like, write this up? So then I wrote papers with Walt.
Ah.
So we, like, you know, we published, like, 5 or 6 papers and, like, you know, doing different things. And I went and like operated with him a lot and he would like let me do all sorts of stuff. This was like kind of before a lot of like the regulations came about. Like, so my sister had her first child in Sioux Falls. And on the day that she like delivered, Walt like let me amputate someone's leg. I mean, he was there, you know, and like did most of it, but he like let me have like the saw and like amputate someone's leg. I wasn't even in medical school yet. So we had like, and he like his PA was awesome, would let me sutra and stuff. And so like, I mean, it was like this incredible thing. And I would like write papers and like do all this stuff. And like, so from like, we've had
that
a really
should probably be the way that we go through our educational process to have the mentorship is often lost, I think.
Exactly. Because, you know, he didn't have like students very often. He didn't have residents or anything. And so like, and we got along, and I, you know, I worked really hard, and also when I wrote papers, it was good for him because people would see the papers. They were most of them were in like the Journal of South Dakota Medicine, so he'd get a lot of referrals from the papers and stuff. But then our relationship turned like into like a friendship, essentially,
yeah,
which was like awesome. Yeah. So anyway, so I, and then I also like studied a ton more for like the MCAT, you know, like when I was in my last year at St. John's, I was like taking twice the class load, you know, to like graduate early, and didn't really study too much for the test. And so then I studied a lot more, and then I got a much better score. So then I applied all over. And then when I went to Georgetown to interview, it was like, I got there and just felt like, oh, this is totally where I want to go, you know? And it was like the best experience. I mean, the best experience ever.
So from that point, did you apply to other schools too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I applied to like a handful all over the country. And I mean, the only reason I even applied to Georgetown was because, oh, I'm probably looking away and...
That's all right.
Okay. The only reason I really even applied to Georgetown was my Spanish teacher's like daughter from high school was at Georgetown for medical school. And she loved it. And it was like, you should apply and come out here. Yep. So we had lunch with her that day. And I walked around. I was like, this place is awesome.
Yeah.
And then afterwards... I mean, I have so many stories. It's like, where do I even like go to? And I remember like when I first got to DC, I had this awesome apartment. My dad like drove me out there and dropped me off, and I had all this IKEA stuff, you know. And he gets up to leave like the next day to like drive back, and he leaves the apartment. And then I get up, I'm like taking the garbage out, and I just have my boxers on. And I lock myself out of my apartment on the first day I'm alone in Washington, D.C. Okay, so like imagine, I'm like this middle-class white guy from Minnesota.
From South Dakota.
Went to college in the middle of the woods in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Now I'm in the nation's capital, locked out of my apartment on the first day in my underwear. And I was just like, and it was early too. It was like, and the office didn't open up until like for another like hour and a half. And I was just like, what am I doing? You know, so
it's probably the best way to start, though. It's all up from there.
Totally. And then, so the first day of medical school, right? They, you know, everyone is like, oh, welcome and all that kind of stuff. So the dean gets up and puts like the slide deck together, right? Well, now I use the term slide deck, but back then it was like presentation.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, we have all these people from Harvard and from Yale and from MIT and all these, that sort of thing. And then it was like, and look at all the countries we have people from and all the states. I was like, oh, that's why I got in here. Because basically they could add another state because I'm from South Dakota, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm like, holy shit, I got locked out of my apartment and now I'm surrounded by all these like brilliant people. And also now I'm like a minority. Because my whole class is, like, you know, Asian and Indian. I was, like, super, I guess, like, terrified, essentially.
Yeah.
But then, you know.
But in terms of, I mean, and what that ends up teaching you, and this is a problem, I think, with, I mean, we see this going on right now in our country, where if you don't have this exposure to be able to, as a doctor, to be able to understand, and we've had this conversation so much about, from a cultural perspective, the belief system of how people believe they're going to get better.
Yes.
You got exposed to that at like 22.
Oh, yeah, totally. And, you know, even the patients are totally different out there than like in South Dakota and stuff, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so I got exposed to like all sorts of different things. And we went to all these different hospitals. You know, another fascinating experience I had there that I just remembered, one of my family medicine rotations was with this guy who saw AIDS patients. Right. Mm. But they were HIV patients who took like their meds and stuff. And it was basically the gay community in one of the neighborhoods. And he was so awesome. And all the patients were like super. Well, of course, because I was like, you know, fairly decent looking guy. So they loved the fact that I was like
young athletic guy from cornbread from South Dakota.
But they were so awesome. And like I totally saw like a completely different, you know, view of like HIV and stuff like that. And, you know, And all these different experiences of different races and different like people of different backgrounds and like, you know, in different like Washington Hospital Center, which is like right by the VA and totally different than Arlington Hospital or like Alexandria where I went, which is super like high end white class where actually I did, I was on the trauma team and ran the whole code on a senator's wife. Like we didn't know until afterwards, like, you know, we stabilized her and stuff. And then this, all the Secret Service came and like my attending kind of looked at me like, oh shit, I probably should not have let you do that whole thing. Cause he didn't know who it was and stuff, but
you got past that
like,
too,
right? All these like different type of stories, but you know, maybe we should go quicker.
For what? For
4 years.
4 years.
Yeah.
And what did you think you wanted to do from there? Did that change through the course of those 4 years?
Well, again, when I first got there, you know, orthopedic surgery, and I knew exactly what I wanted to. And it turned out that Georgetown matches more people in orthopedics than any other place. You know how sometimes things just kind of end up aligning?
Yeah.
And so I ended up doing super well in medical school because after my first 6 months and kind of getting over the, oh, everyone's like way smarter than me, started doing like really well in tests and stuff. And then I realized that medical school is very like a self-study. Like to be, you know, a doctor, you really have to be curious and also you have to learn a lot of stuff on your own. And there wasn't enough time in the day to literally go to class and listen to lecture and study. So I ended up hardly ever going to class for like a year and a half and would just like study on my own and walk around. I had this awesome friend who would just, we would meet at the gym every morning and then we would like go and like study together, but not like together, but like just in our own thing. And so we were like accountable.
Just to stay on track. Yeah.
And I think that totally is a corollary to health too. Like if you can have someone that you can be accountable to, you don't even have to do things together. Yeah. I mean, it's like huge. Anyway, so then I did like, you know, like quite well. And the other thing too about knowing the hierarchy, like I realized like in clinic and in the hospital and stuff, if you're nice to the nurses and, you know, are helpful to people, then you can do well. People like you and then you get better grades. I mean, that's, I feel like I could really help a lot of people who want to go to medical school or like do well in medical school by like, maybe like coaching them a little bit.
Well, and maybe this kind of, you know, podcast is good for someone who's considering it because they can sort of hear your story. And I think we're always in such a rush to get to this idea we have from a point of view that was really lacking in experience. We don't know that until we get past all these hurdles.
Oh my
gosh. But I think to some extent, knowing your story, your story is a story of making mistakes and recovering.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Making huge mistakes.
Yeah.
And actually looking, so, you know, I ended up going to the Mayo Clinic for orthopedic surgery and it was kind of, you know, it was my top choice and all those types of things. And then looking back, you know, a few years later, in my last part of third year of medical school at Georgetown, I did 2 weeks on the plastic surgery service and I just like loved it. And
what was it about the plastic surgery?
I mean, I think it was like the atmosphere and also just like the technical like aspect of like orthopedics is awesome, but it's also like a meticulous trait I mean, you know, where you like, you do the same thing over and over again and you get really good at like putting you know, in total hips and total knees and stuff. And there's like, there's very much a solution to a lot of the problems. Like total hip replacement and total knee replacement are some of the most successful operations in all of the history of medicine.
Yeah.
You know, so it feels really awesome to be able to put up an x-ray of say someone's like, you know, hip or knee and they like can't walk. You spend an hour, you put in a new one, and now they can walk and you've changed a life. Yeah. I mean, there is just something incredible about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I, you know, from because I'm on the more preventative side of things, I get those people, you know, as things are starting to kind of get off track a little bit. And, you know, from my point of view, because I've worked with a lot of these now, it's still great to get them to do the work leading up to the surgery because they recover so much better when they, you know, go through it. And a lot of people are just so worried about what surgery is going to mean to their life. But having been through it enough now with different people, I start to kind of talk to them about what their lifestyle you know, where they're at now, what's changed in their life, where they're limited, what things they're not doing anymore because of it, and then see this person a month after, you know, hip replacement, really, like, already, I mean, they're going to have some swelling and some stuff for a while, but already their lifestyle has changed, like, 1,000%. So, totally. I mean, it's incredible.
And they don't even realize oftentimes at how much their life had changed.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not even aware of, like, how many things they're not doing anymore because their knee or hip hurts.
Yeah,
it's incredible. So, I mean, there's so much value to that, and I saw that very early, you know, like with Walt, and just, you know, seeing his patients and oftentimes how happy they were afterwards, and it's a very, very rewarding thing. But during those 2 weeks in plastic surgery and medical school, I saw, like, a completely different form of surgery where the problems don't have clear answers.
Yeah.
And you have to be very, like, you know, kind of creative and artistic, and at that time I didn't really think I was, but a lot of people in medical school say you'll kind of find the specialty based on how you fit in, you know, with that group of people. Yeah. And I did always kind of feel like I was a bit of an outsider, well, in a lot of aspects of my life, but especially, like, you know, like orthopedics, I could fit in, you know, if I needed to. And I've recently learned, we went to this, like, relationship seminar last week on the Enneagram. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's an interesting thing. And so I learned a lot about myself actually there. And I realized that it's one of my traits is essentially being able to kind of blend in, you know? And so, totally. And I bet we're the same number.
Probably.
Yeah. And so I set this goal so early when I was, you know, younger, and then I basically just kind of kept aligned to that.
Yeah.
And so when I, and it startled me actually during those 2 weeks of, like, the plastic surgery thing, because I was like, I never wavered really, you know, it was orthopedics. And then during those 2 weeks, I was like, oh shit, I think this is what I'm supposed to do. And I kind of talked to a few people about it, you know, but I just couldn't get over the fact that I had all these other things lined up for, like, orthopedics. I just, like, wasn't able to, like, kind of change, you know. And then when I went to the Mayo Clinic in my first year of orthopedics, you do a month of hand surgery, which is on the plastic surgery department.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was with Dr. Moran, who is, like, one of the most incredible people I've met in, like, along the way.
Yeah.
He's the chair of the plastic surgery department. And for 2 days during that month, we drove up to the Children's Hospital, the Shriners Hospital in St. Paul.
Oh, yeah.
And I spent some time with him and, like, just saw, like, what he did and that sort of thing. I mean, it was just awesome. So from that point, I was like, I'm going to do hand surgery.
Yeah.
But also, not totally sure what I was going to do afterwards because, you know, this hospital from my back from home, Avera, like, ended up paying for my medical school in exchange for me to come back, you know, to do 3 years of orthopedics. Like, my contract said orthopedics, right? So even when I was in those 2 weeks of plastic surgery, like, to change.
Like, seems like kind of a bad deal on their part to, like, I mean, take a risk at a 22-year-old to stick with one thing now for, you know, pre-medical school. I mean, if I look back at how my career has sort of, you know, I never thought I was going to work in pediatrics.
Right.
I was working with athletes with chronic, you know, sort of injuries. I was working with, you know, just general, you know, back issues.
Yeah.
I love working with newborns now.
Right.
Like, I can't imagine not having that be part of my practice, but, you know.
How would you know that early on?
At the beginning of my career. You were in orthopedic surgery residency at Mayo with this, you know, sense that you had to go back and work for Avera for 2 to 3 years or something.
Yeah, it was for 3 years. And so essentially, once I got to the Mayo Clinic, you know, it's funny, the way I say it now when I tell my story is kind of like, you know, I was at the Mayo Clinic in orthopedic surgery and kind of had everything I thought I ever wanted.
Right.
Because once I got there, that sealed the deal from afterwards. Like, basically, like, after I was done, I would have been back to Sioux Falls for 3 years and that sort of thing, even though in my heart I knew I didn't really want to go back there. But anyway, so kind of during my first year, I was really kind of grappling with this. Like, oh my gosh, what am I going to, like, is this really what I want to do? I've got here, but this is totally not really what I signed up for in many ways, I guess, because what I saw, I mean, a lot of different things, but basically, I mean, how can I even explain some of this stuff, you know, just like seeing how like the business of medicine and how like once you get into these huge healthcare systems, a lot of people, you don't even have like decision-making anymore. Like there's, and especially with these electronic systems.
Yeah, explain that a little bit. How does the decision-making work?
Yeah. It's really pretty complicated. And in many ways it's very like architected from like the top down. Yeah. And as you know, medicine has become a business, and much more so as like the years have gone on, and with different payers and different stuff like that, the people who started becoming administrators of hospitals were no longer doctors anymore. You know, I mean, the Mayo Clinic is kind of different because the one who's like the CEO now, I think, is actually a doctor too. But still, there's so many layers of management of people who actually aren't clinicians or aren't health professionals. And yeah. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
But when you're looking at the numbers or you're looking at risk, this is the other thing, too, to think about. So you're looking at the finances, but you're also looking at the risk, right? So imagine someone comes into the emergency room with, like, abdominal pain, right?
Yeah.
So if you give, say, the ER doctor, you know, the choice of what to do and what test to order and that sort of thing, there's a lot more inherent risk into that, right? If you don't, say, make templates or make these guidelines to make the doctor order CT scans with contrast on every single person who comes in, or make them order all of these labs who come in. And sometimes it's inadvertent, or it's not like you have to do this. It's, hey, we have this system, right? Now you have to click through all these boxes. So to get to the next box, you have to click this, right? And so it's not as like, and so I started seeing all these things of like, you know, we were ordering all these tests and like, and everything, and hardly ever did we even do anything or even look at like the results half the time, you know what I mean? And
it takes you out of your creative role or your, the
human role,
and your experience in it, because you're now just filling out boxes of paperwork.
Exactly.
That will lead you to one way or one direction or another. It's like a flow chart for you, right?
It's exactly what it is. And especially as we went from paper, you know, to these electronic systems, and when they're built by, say, tech people, you know, part of that is the user interface is awful and like, and it's hard to navigate. The other thing is when the, you know, administrators like are involved in, say, the template making or in the guideline making or in the flowchart making, then one, you order a ton of tests,
right?
And then you order a ton of labs and a ton of, you know, like x-rays. And like some people end up like in the hospital many times, and you look back, they're like, wow, they've had 25 CT scans. Like, how are they not like radioactive at this point? Right. And so I saw a lot of that. And then once you finish your first year of any sort of residency, then you take your last board exam.
Okay.
So then at that point, then I'm a licensed doctor. And I'm a licensed, basically, general practitioner. And so so then you can actually do moonlighting in different programs. So in my second year at the Mayo Clinic.
Staying there?
Or you can, do moonlighting in different places.
Okay.
And so in my second year, I ended up doing, like, a special enfolded, like, research thing. So in the orthopedic program, you could get a master's degree if you did this extra research thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Darren, my friend in New York, he and I were the only two that did it that year. That's how we became such close friends.
Yeah.
So I was doing this like four-dimensional CT scanning, like research stuff, along with like covering the trauma team. But I also had a little bit more free time. So I started moonlighting at this urgent care in Apple Valley.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
You know, so a lot of like these places that have a hard time, say, getting like doctors to cover or, you know, at night. And so what I would do is like I would drive up and then I work the overnight. And then I drive back, which is a little. I know. I mean, there's a lot of insanity, whatever.
Yeah.
But it was such an awesome experience. And then I started seeing like, because I was all on my own, right? And then I started seeing like all these people come in and I was the only one there. Like I had to make the decisions and that sort of thing. And I had to make the decision on tests and stuff like that. And realizing like, oh man, like this is different. And we don't need a lot of these tests. And we don't, because if you sit and listen to the patient, like they will tell you the answer often. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. And a lot of the testing and, you know, like medicine is either financially driven or risk management driven,
right?
Right, or also not feeling comfortable about your own skill set.
So, does this happen at the higher levels in these organizations too, not just residency? I mean, I can understand where they might be risk averse when there's a newer doctor having to make decisions, but is it happening all along?
Absolutely. So imagine any like private hospital or anything like that, or even in like different medical clinics, right? When you are looking at it from the top down and thinking about like one, you know, finances, they make a lot of their money based on how many labs and x-rays they make money off of. That's the whole fee for service thing.
Yeah,
like, if you listen to a lot of like the debate about Obamacare and all that kind of stuff, transferring this fee for service to value based healthcare, they're calling it, you know?
Yeah.
So basically, instead of getting paid per test you order or per, visit or any of that kind of stuff, it's basically how healthy the person is.
Per outcome.
Yeah, which is another, I mean, there's all sorts of problems with that too.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, so it happens kind of like all over the place. And the other thing I started seeing too, this is where I really started seeing the problem with medications.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I was in this urgent care and I was writing paper prescriptions. So what would happen is people would take the paper prescriptions over to this pharmacy, and there was only one 24-hour Walgreens in the area. So I would get, and I was seeing so many people there. Like sometime, I remember one time I saw almost 70 patients in a 12-hour shift over like the flu season, right? So what would happen is like these people would take the paper prescription to Walgreens, and then sometimes like a few hours later, the pharmacist would call me and be like, "Well, their insurance doesn't cover this one. Do you think we can?" And I'm like, "Wait, who is that? I don't even know who that person is anymore." I'm like totally drowning all these, you know, and just realize. So what happened was, I got so interested in this that I ended up shadowing like I went over and just like asked like, "Hey, can I hang out with you for like a night and just see?" So I realized that actually pharmacists, especially in these like chains, they are incentivized to only put pills into the bottle and deal with the insurance, and they hardly ever really educate the patient on the prescription.
Yeah.
So like I hardly have any time. I'm like, okay, so I do, you know, I talk to the patient, examine them, decide on a treatment, you know, and then give them a prescription. I can't like really go over everything, right? And you expect as a doctor
that could be another job, and you know, I mean,
exactly. And so I always thought like, oh, they'll go to the pharmacy, get the thing, and the pharmacist will go over and like,
yeah.
That is not what happens. And I just realized, you know, and so and a lot of people were coming in, and I'm just realizing that. Their medications are causing a lot of their problems too, you know?
So is this where you start thinking about like, how can technology solve some of these issues?
100%. Absolutely. Because, seeing that this communication thing is broken between the pharmacist and the doctor. And actually I spent so much time in that area.
Yeah.
And I actually when I first started doing like Quick Life stuff, you know, that was one of the big things, was actually trying to fix that communication, because people are on so many medications.
So explain Quick Life a little bit. Like what is the evolution of the beginning of this concept that you had?
Yeah. So, I guess one step further. So the other thing I started seeing in this urgent care too, and also, like at the Mayo Clinic, because remember, I'm still like doing trauma surgery. I'm still like involved, you know, in patient care at the Mayo Clinic and doing research at the same time. And I start to see how important like real health is, meaning like what people are putting into their bodies, right?
Yeah.
So the food.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you the number of times I ate McDonald's when I was like in residency.
Yeah.
Because what would happen is I'd like work the overnight shift, be so tired in the morning. I'd look at the grocery store, be like, that is way too much work, right? And then, but what's always open? McDonald's. And by the time you get to the second window, they have like your food out hanging for you, right? And then so I would basically eat it by the time I get home and pass out.
Yeah.
And I just like realize how convenience is such like, and you know, we talked about this earlier, people having two jobs and have kids, and like, how can you like really look out for your own health and do all the other things like in your life?
Yeah.
It's super like
when
difficult.
The demands start to kick in. I mean, doctors have an extreme of that. But there are a lot of jobs like that. I mean, my wife works in, you know, an auditing accounting firm. I mean, my job ends up being that, partly because I'm the flex parent. I'm also working a job. And, you know, you're also at this point in your life where you have your children, but you're also, your parents are aging. Anything that starts to come up with them, you're kind of you're sandwiched in between as caretaker for both of these things. And the convenience part of things starts to become, you know, more and more.
I mean, absolutely, 100%. And the way that you just said that is totally what I saw. Yeah. And I kept seeing, actually, that, you know, the people who are going to change, like, the next chapter of our world, but especially in this country and especially, like, in healthcare, are the professional women, okay?
Yeah.
Because, like, the professional women are the ones who are, like, taking care of their parents, right?
Yeah.
But also taking care of their kids,
yeah.
And are the ones who are, like, trying to keep their family healthy.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you, almost every single night I worked at the urgent care, a woman would come in at, like, 2 or 3 in the morning, like, and was having a breakdown because
yeah.
she was basically, like, trying to do too much.
Yeah.
It was almost
yeah.
like every night. I can't
oh,
even
wow.
tell you. And I just kept seeing this, like, that, like, those are, yeah, like, those are the people. But so the first idea that started to come out was this thing called quick pods, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And my sister was, like, in Italy at the time, and she was, like, a business person and stuff. We were, like, throwing around all these ideas, and, like, the whole quick pods thing came out because of how hard it is to actually get healthy food, all those kind of things. And we wanted to, like, make this, you know, drive-through 24-hour thing that you could basically get any sort of, like, healthy food or you know, anything.
It's like those vending machines where you push the number and the button and
exactly,
it comes
down. But that you could drive through, so then you never yeah. had, and you could order on your phone before, like, you got there and stuff
yeah.
like that, you know? And we were, like, way before our time. And when I left, like, when I took, like, the leave of absence, you know, I kind of, told them that that's what I was going to do. But it was more that, like, I just needed a break to figure out what I really wanted to
yeah,
do.
Yeah.
The other piece of this was, in my second year doing this research thing, I had to write grants to get my research funded.
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw some of these, like, wrist implants and that people were using. And I was like, well, these are really bad. And I started kind of, like, drawing a few different ones. And so one of my mentors was like, oh, you should turn this into Mayo Ventures. And I was like, what is that? I didn't even know what that was.
Yeah.
So that was that actually was my whole entry into the whole Silicon Valley thing. So I was watching, like, TED videos all the time, and there's, like, the Stanford Entrepreneurial Thought Leader Series podcast.
Yeah.
So I listened to all those things. And so by the time I left, I had turned in, like, maybe 6 or 7, like, invention disclosures to them. I, like, hardly ever heard back too many of them, but 2 of them they ended up, like, pursuing 2 wrist implants, and one of them actually they got a patent on, and some company is, like, licensing the deal right now. There's a whole nother learning about, like, the politics within, like, the academia and research. And I will just say that many people from the outside looking in think that, like, money, you know, like, drives healthcare, and it totally does in many ways,
yeah.
and thinks that that's so, like, you know, evil. So what people started doing is when you write papers, you had to do a financial disclosure, meaning, like, if you get money from different, you know, companies or whatever, like, you had to put that on your paper.
Yeah.
Well, in one of the classes I took, because I was getting a graduate degree too, and so, like, was this research in ethics, and they were going on and on about this financial disclosure and stuff, and I raised my hand, and I was like, my friend sitting next to me, Darren, you know,
yeah.
like, wants to be the chair of some, you know, program someday. And so, like, the, you know, the ego, or I didn't say that, I said it something way more, like, eloquently at the time, but basically, like, you know, in research and in academia, like, people want their names on everything,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And, like, that type of, like, you know, influence is just as much, like, influencing medicine, if not more than the finances. And so I learned a lot about that too.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is interesting.
So where did you go with so the quick pods thing kind of came and went, and you decided it was too much.
Yeah. So then my sister and I went to Spain for 3 months.
Yeah.
And I could do a whole thing down there,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I mean, I should keep moving here.
But something happened there for you.
Oh yeah. Basically. So, I mean, a lot of things. And I basically spent, like, 3 months walking around this city, Valencia. They have this awesome park. It's almost like Central Park.
Yeah.
And I basically spent, like, 3 months, like, walking around trying to figure out, like, what had happened, right?
Because
I had, like, everything I thought I ever wanted on a silver platter.
Yeah.
And like was like very unhappy, ended up like I was on a personal leave of absence to like figure out like what the hell happened, yeah. What am I going to do type of thing. And at the same time, knowing that there's a lot of things that I wanted to change about like the system, right? And I learned all these like stuff from TED Talks and Stanford Entrepreneurial Thought Leader Series, but like my like foundation was like out from underneath me, right?
Yeah.
And I remember sitting on the balcony with my sister, because my sister came like with me, and I looked over at an apartment building. This is like kind of like my analogy, right? And this apartment building was like 20 stories high or something. And the first floor, you know, had lights on, and then kind of lights throughout the rest of the building. And I said, you know, if I go back to finish my residency, it'll be, you know, it'll be fine. Like, I'll be happy, that sort of thing. And I'll be able to help the people on the first floor, right?
Yeah.
But if I, like, do something different, if I, like, take a risk and really try to, like, do this other bigger thing that I don't know exactly what it is,
yeah.
but I know it's something different,
yeah.
then maybe there's a chance I could help the rest of the people in the whole building.
Yeah.
And the fact now that I see this, like, how in the world am I supposed to go back and only help the people on the first floor, knowing that if I would have risked my own personal, like, you know, accolades or whatever you want to call it, knowing in my heart that I could have done something different, like, I wouldn't have been able to, like, kind of live with myself. So I think yeah. at that moment, I was just like, okay, I have to do this other thing. And I was like, well, it seems like all this stuff is like in Silicon Valley and like the, you know, and I totally believe in tech, totally believe in like technology, if done correctly, can make like things a lot more efficient, a lot better if you align incentives, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so I was like, I just want to like put myself in the middle of it. Right. And so yeah. when we moved back, we moved to San Jose.
Next level of education, basically. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's because once you saw that, now you need to see okay. I can't ignore that thing. I have to go explore this now.
Exactly. There was like no choice.
It was like, it's like you're back in Georgetown studying on your own with your study partner. Now you got to go find someone to do this with.
Yeah, exactly. And so what happened was, we moved to San Jose, and then I was flying back and forth. I mean, I still had to work, right?
Yeah.
And the only way we went to Spain for 3 months is because I like was working in that urgent care for so long, and I saved up this pile of money to yeah. like, you know, and that's when I moved from the urgent care to this rural hospital in Dawson, Minnesota, right?
Yeah.
Because, to get a medical license in another state often takes a lot longer. And so, I started working in this urgent care in Dawson, Minnesota. And so I was covering the emergency room, the inpatient hospital. I did a primary care clinic 2 days a week, and the nursing home was connected to it. So I basically would like fly to Minneapolis, where my car was parked at a friend's house. And then I would drive 2.5 hours to the hospital. I would stay at the hospital.
You were driving fast, because I went out to Dawson one time, like 4 hours.
Or maybe 3 hours.
It's a long drive.
Yeah, it is. And I would stay there for 96-hour shifts. And so I would sleep in the hospital and that sort of thing. And then I would, come back, and I would go to, like, all these meetings and conferences and trying to, like, figure out, like, you know, how I can make all this stuff work. And at the
helping people in this rural community in Dawson, or?
Well, no, how I could, like, basically, you know, I was learning all this stuff in tech, so when I would fly back, I would, like, go to all these conferences out here. Or I would, go to stuff at Stanford, or I would, like, read, you know, and trying to figure out kind of, like, what, like business model I was going to try to, like, you know, do, because, you know, what I learned... I mean, we kind of tried to do the QuickPod thing a little bit. So I figured out like this other company that made something similar. So mm-hmm. we were going to kind of like lease some of those like big vending machine type of thing. And I actually got like a couple of friends who were like lawyers and stuff. And I had saved up some money. We were going to like put some money in together, you know, and then I decided we just didn't want to do that anymore. I found out later that they ended up like trying to do it without telling me. It was another thing another thing I learned is you got to be careful with like who you let in the circle on the truck. Yeah, I mean, I've learned so much, and most of it just big, falling straight on my face, basically. So I was flying back and forth, and then, and you know, like I was saying with the whole pharmacy thing, I like realized that there was like this big disconnection between the doctors and the pharmacist, right? And I started learning a ton more about that industry and realizing, like, holy cow, there is like a ginormous opportunity financially, you know, with a company. And so I started going to these conferences and telling kind of people what I was like thinking about doing, right? And the idea was essentially, if a patient is sitting next to me, like in the clinic, right, and I want to write a prescription or I want to, like, you know, send prescriptions, that sort of thing, like, it would be so much better if there was a pharmacist sitting virtually next to me, right?
Yeah.
So they could be somewhere else, but like over video,
yeah,
right? That they could review the prescription in real time, check against their insurance company, and then send me something, or we could talk about it right there before the patient left.
Yeah.
Right. And so that was kind of like the idea. And what I realized is that there's these huge, huge multi-billion dollar company called Pharmacy Benefit Managers. Mm-hmm. So your insurance company subcontracts out to these people, right? And they created this network that connects all of the pharmacies, all of the electronic medical record systems that send prescriptions, right?
Yeah.
And their systems that check insurance. So like the pharmacy systems have been integrated for a lot longer, right? And I started to realize this. And I also started to realize that they like make billions of dollars and don't add a whole lot of value.
Right.
And so when I started telling some of these people here, like, you need to get a lawyer, man. Like, you need to get a lawyer soon.
Yeah.
And so they told me that some of these big law firms out here act kind of like venture capitalists. And so I ended up emailing, like, I found this guy at Fenwick & West. It's like this huge, like, law firm out here. And I emailed him, and he took a meeting with me. He was super awesome, super, super awesome. And he was Facebook's lawyer until they went public. His name is Michael Escoville. He's super, super awesome guy.
Yeah.
And he looked at me and he goes, and so I made this, like, you know, I figured out how to make this, these slide decks, you know, so I made a slide deck and I made my own website on Squarespace and figured it, like, basically like made it appear that I knew what I was like doing and talking about, which I totally didn't. And I feel like that was another one of my huge mistakes, was like basically like almost like making it appear that I knew what I was doing and I had no idea. Anyways, he looked at me and goes, Aaron, that's really pretty complicated, but I really believe in you. I mean, that you like gave up what you gave up to come out here to do this. Like, and so he, like, they took like me on as like a client in like deferred payment and stuff. And basically like, and so anyway, so I flew around like the country kind of like meeting with different people in the pharmacy chain and stuff like that. And what I realized was that this business model is awesome, but it's years out. In a way of what I wanted to do. And at the same time, because I was flying around, I took Uber for the first time, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's where, like, I determined that, like, a better business model was where you could request a nurse to your GPS location and then who video chats to a doctor. So I realized by doing, you know, the stuff in Dawson and urgent care, I realized, holy cow, almost the entire outpatient healthcare system could be done in your home.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was a much better thing to start with. People could understand it. The other thing, the pharmacy thing, was actually like, could be very awesome, but it was complicated and technical and that sort of thing. And so, and this one was very much, like people could relate to it. Like,
it's like old medicine, right? You would have your family doctor.
Yeah. And it, you know, anyone who had a kid or anything like that could easily, like, you know, identify with, that would be so much better than having to take my kid in, all those types of
time
things.
Time saving and just a relationship with this person.
Yeah. So I you know, raised like some money from family and friends, which, of course, if I look back on it now, I totally would never do that because, like, the amount of pressure is just awful. And then I had hired actually a third, like, another company to basically build stuff for me, which is another mistake because, like, they were an enterprise company and I was like a startup. So, like, they basically, like, wouldn't return my emails.
You didn't go to business school.
I know. I was just like falling on my face over and over and over again. Right. So then I was like, oh, that's not going to work. So I started like, trying to hire people, you know, and I actually had an awesome, I mean, like, the people that I really, like, I guess, brought onto the team were so awesome. I just like didn't know how to manage people. Right. And I doctors are not great business people for many reasons, but I've learned that one of the major things is because we care about people. Yeah. So if you care about people more than you care about the business, then
I've
things
had the
just
same
like,
problems in business. Right. I know.
And it's just like, fell in my face again. So anyway, so I hired like way too many people and was like flying back and forth trying to work all this stuff and like go to like angel investor meetings and stuff and just like basically like totally like killed half of myself somewhere along the line. And then I was like, okay, I want to not have to go back to Dawson as often because it was like a big thing. And I had actually got an apartment in Minneapolis. Yep. And so what I wanted to do was actually, you know, I love being a doctor. And what I realized all along the way was like, I do really love being a doctor. And those times when I'm like really helping one person like grounds myself and keeps me like grounded to be able to do all these other things. Right. Yeah. And so what I wanted to do was do it in a way that, I didn't have to have like administrators and stuff kind of like tell me what to do. So that's when I wanted to do like the direct primary care thing. And I found like an ad in Craigslist in Minneapolis that like the Healing Garage was like looking for someone to like rent some space.
Yeah.
So then that's where I met like you and Michelle. And that our first conversation was like 4 hours long or something. Do you know what I mean? It was like I was going to come check out the space and it was like four hours later.
It was amazing.
I know. And that was really kind of where, I mean, definitely where our relationship started and also where we started seeing all this overlap.
Yeah.
Right? Where there's so much overlap where patients go between holistic providers and, you know, traditional allopath. I don't know what the word, you know, it's weird how, But anyways, and a lot of people don't feel comfortable telling us as doctors that they go and see holistic providers and kind of the reverse because there's so much controversy, which is weird between the two of us.
Or there's just conflict. Some people like from my side, there are people who have all these biases against allopaths, which is problematic. And I have to deal with that a lot of times. So, I mean, I think we were both sort of approaching things from the same point. I was really curious to know more about what you did personally because you were going to be kind of working with some of my people and vice versa, and I treated you, and all of a sudden we started kind of learning that started opening this up, which is really, I have to credit you to some extent, meeting you for starting the podcast, because that was the whole intention of the podcast now too, is to kind of open up that dialogue.
Definitely. And also we ended up having services from each other. It was actually embarrassing when you told me that you did craniosacral stuff, and I didn't even know what that was.
Yeah.
You know, and Walt does spine surgery, and I did spine surgery, and all these types of things, and I had kind of, you know, like massages and stuff, but I didn't really understand the whole holistic thing. But because I'm, you know, quite curious about everything, I remember when I was still like at the Mayo Clinic, and I had some vacation time, I got like all these like coupons and went and did like float tank and I did acupuncture and I walked in, the guy was like, so why are you here? I was like, well, I'm a doctor and my patients have asked me about acupuncture. I've never done it or anything. Can you just kind of give me a general treatment and show me kind of what you do? Yeah. And so like when I had a treatment with you, it was awesome because I had no idea, and learning about, you know, all this like, you know, theories behind it, all the things that you believe are so actually complementary to what I believe.
Oh. And to the work that you were doing. I mean, to orthopedics, too.
Yeah, totally. So, yeah. It was just, like, super interesting. So, basically, like, I only ended up seeing, like, very few patients there because every time I came back, like, I just wanted to hang out with, like, you and Michelle. And, like, we just, like, hung out and talked and figured out, like, oh, my gosh, there's so much overlap between what we do.
Yeah.
And yet it's not, you know, connected in that way.
Yeah.
And so this was really kind of, like, as, like, I was falling apart with, like, you know, like the Quick Life stuff because I had hired too many people, and like, and all like the VCs and like the angels investors and stuff that I was talking to were like, oh my gosh, like, you know, this is totally an awesome idea. The whole, you know, I ended up starting using the tagline like Uber for like urgent care type of stuff, you know, and yet it wasn't, I don't know. And so basically they were like, oh yeah, this is awesome. Come back to us like when you have like proof of concept. And so I got caught in this like place where I'm sure so many people who start companies get caught in this place of, you know, we need money to build the product, but you need product to raise the money.
Right.
And at that time, like I was paying like engineers, like our team and stuff, you know, but didn't really know enough about it. So then as things like fell apart, then I started to learn more and more about the tech, because I was like, well, like, I took money from family and friends, and I don't know what I'm going to do now.
Yeah.
And like, I needed to figure out like how to do this thing a whole lot better. And at the same time, as those things were falling apart, our conversations were getting like, you know, like more and more aligned with like, I think what we both believe. And yeah. also like where I saw like a huge kind of like, you know, the transition, I guess you could say.
Yeah. And even some of the, I think some of the companies that you were starting to talk to about your product, and just where our conversations were going, we're starting to connect. And that's probably why I would kind of attend some of the meetings with you. Because really what we are trying to figure out is how to bridge some of the, so many different aspects of this. I mean, to have a truly integrative experience in you know, your, whatever it was you were trying to improve was just lacking, whether it was through communication or through, you know, sharing some kind of lab results, or making sure that someone, even follow up, making sure that someone was really being handed off correctly and taken care of.
Absolutely.
And then there's, you know, then there's the whole pharmaceutical part of what you were talking about before too.
Yeah. So basically everything is, you know, totally just disjointed. Like nothing was actually like connected.
Yeah.
And actually I later realized as I was learning more and more about all this stuff that there's so much incentive to actually be disconnected business-wise in medicine. So think about this, right? So think about you're in a big city and you're a patient, right? And so you'll get your insurance from your like employer, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one like disconnection, right? So your insurance basically tells you like who you can go to, yeah. right? So that means that like you probably can't go and see like Jeremy and like me and get it like, you know, covered. So that's one disconnection, right?
Right.
So the other one is, imagine there's two huge hospitals, right?
Yeah.
And like, if you could go to see a doctor in the morning at one place and then go see a doctor at the other place in the afternoon, and all the records would be connected. So like, then there's disincentive for the hospitals because they want to keep their patients all under one roof.
Right.
Like if patients could go back and forth, that's bad for their business model, right?
Yeah.
And so there's all these incentives within the healthcare system to keep things in silos and not connected,
yeah.
right? The separation of say holistic providers and allopathic, like a lot of like that kind of controversy is not from like the providers like you and me, right?
No.
It's from like this history of kind of, you know, people talking back and forth like, oh, like chiropractors don't know what they're doing, or doctors just let me use, you know, and all sorts
and
like,
and it exists out there, but I don't think that's the biggest driving part of why people aren't going to these people. I think there's a huge, the whole alternative, you know, holistic industry is huge now.
Yes,
and I think it's, you know, it has grown because of this disjointed system.
I couldn't agree more, because as more people have experiences in the traditional healthcare system that has become a business, they feel more and more like a number and less and less like a human.
Yeah.
And a lot of these holistic providers that I've interacted with, I'm like, that's the way things should be.
Yeah.
And you get to spend time, like in my job now, I'm supposed to see people in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And like, yeah. you get to, like,
and that's a long time for some places.
Right. Yeah. There are a lot of orthopedic offices that see people every 7 minutes,
yeah.
do you know, like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so so there's all this just, you know, disconnection,
yeah.
right? So even the pharmacist and the doctor thing, that was basically like there's disconnection there because like the doctors and the pharmacist are in different organizations
yeah.
and they're not incentivized to like be connected.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of, I guess, like the theme across like a lot of these, you know, I guess different models that I was like trying to pursue and that sort of thing. And then with what you were trying to do like in Brooklyn by say connecting all these people and in different fields. So then you didn't have to spend as much time like basically,
yeah.
you know, like trying to connect people over email and that sort of thing and not knowing, you know, if the other person is like following up or how to keep that all connected, even though you weren't even getting, you know, reimbursed for that.
And it wasn't even about that. It was really
I have
long-term relationships with these whole families. When one person starts to have a problem, I want to make sure that they're taken care of. And I felt like, you know, and I have to say, just going back to what you were saying, like I started to, just working with you, I started to feel for the doctors who were, you know, struggling in these situations, because people were coming into me with things that they weren't really appropriate for me. And so I wanted to get them back to the doctors, but they were so frustrated with the system of approach, and the doctors were in the same situation where they were frustrated because they weren't seeing the success they wanted to have.
100%. And so many of like the doctors and colleagues like basically get into these systems because they leave medical school with so much debt, and they have families, and like you can't be as entrepreneurial when you have a family and you have $300,000 in debt. Do you know what I mean? And there's hardly any other options. Not only that, to deal with the whole payment side of like the allopathic side of medicine, to deal with like the insurance and coding and billing and keeping up with regulations and HIPAA and OSHA and all these different like regulatory bodies and stuff, to be able to like practice medicine, you know, to be a good doctor, to say keep up on the most current like knowledge and try to like say run a practice and stay up with the regulations and insurance and keep the lights on and have a relationship and maybe be a decent parent. I mean, I don't even see if that's possible.
Right.
So then they end up just like being in these systems super unhappy and not even providing like the care that they really want to. Yeah. And it's, I feel for a lot of these people, and I'm just fortunate that I don't have children.
Yeah.
I will say that like my relationship with, you know, Gellert totally has been difficult because of a lot of these things.
I can imagine having two people both involved in health.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think there are. I see that a lot of times. I can't imagine the pressures.
Yeah.
So where do you see things going from here? Just with you personally. In terms of your career, what you've gathered so far as information now is incredible.
Yeah.
Where do you see 5 years from now?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I really look back on it, especially through this conversation, I'm actually saying it out loud too, and just seeing like, you know, again, the path, and I have, you know, really acquired a lot along the way. You know, making so many mistakes, meeting so many awesome people, and, you know, reading so much and being exposed to different things. And, I mean, listening to podcasts too, you know, like we've talked about. And now I'm in this, you know, interesting place in my, you know, job. I'm, you know, as like this primary care doctor in like Northern California in this place, you know, in this burning clinic. And I'm seeing everything, and it's awesome. And it's good because like I'm like rebuilding myself again, you know, because like I feel like I just like burned like myself to the ground again.
It seems to me like a perfect place for you right now, because I think when we first started talking, you saw the potential of the using telemedical in a situation like this, especially in a mountain town where you can't even get there sometimes because of weather or road conditions or whatever. You know, at the same time, once you start working in these, the sort of like my Brooklyn experience was, once you start working in these communities, you become very close to these families, and you want to make sure that they're served as you know, quickly and easily as possible.
Absolutely.
And that's just an opportunity for you, I think. And it sounds like that's what's starting to happen there.
Yeah, exactly. I know, because now I started kind of working with the CEO of the local hospital, and they want me to be like the director of their telemedicine program. I guess they just got awarded a big grant for telemedicine too. There's like only two sites in the whole state of California and stuff. So
yeah.
I'm really, really looking forward to like, you know, helping them with that and taking a lot of like the knowledge that I've learned. But you hit it totally spot on, which is, you know, in places like this, in places like Dawson, where I was before, you know, people end up having to drive like, you know, 2 hours to see someone, you know. And the other thing, I mean, this even goes back to what I was seeing like at the Mayo Clinic. So people would drive 8-10 hours to see us in follow-up after, say, like a total hip or a total knee or follow-up before, and they would see us for like less than 10 minutes. And often
they come from somewhere else in the world, right?
Exactly. Isn't that? And most of the time they were like seeing the resident like me.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, wait a minute, we could easily do this with, they could get x-rays done at their local facility and have a video chat with us, and they wouldn't have to drive 20 hours, you know? Yeah. So that combined with then being like, you know, at the urgent care and seeing, gosh, if only like we could have a virtual pharmacist sitting next to us over video and we could optimize these prescriptions before they, like, the person leaves, right? And then doing it again in Dawson and seeing these people have to drive so far, you know, or if I could just like have, you know, a cardiologist quick over and you know, just to consult. And yeah. Now, again, in this Northern California place, in this rural town, and now I'm definitely getting much more connected to the community. Like in Dawson, I was back and forth and like, I wasn't permanent, you know, I was like, kinda, I was doing it temporary. Yeah. And now like I'm becoming really part of this community.
Yeah.
And I'm getting, you know, much more connected to like my patients. And so if I do want to say, send someone to like a neurologist, I don't want to just like send them just to a neurologist. Yeah. Like I want to send them to someone I know is going to be like, treat them really
back
well.
To my network.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You know, because it's hard. Or like, you know, sending them to like holistic providers and where, like, that's like, is their insurance going to cover it? Like all those types of things. Are they any good? And even how would I even know if they're any good? Because that's not like my field type of stuff, you know?
And that's where I think technology can serve, because we can, you know, the relationships are the important part. It's not all about speed of care delivery. And I think that's where it seems like that's where tech is going right now in health. But we need to improve the relationships. And I think that's, you know, another big thing that I'm hoping that, you know, something like this podcast helps us, you know, see who these people are, deals with some of the biases, and, you know, maybe gives people some more ideas about building these networks for themselves, because that's how we improve care.
Totally. And I'm definitely a lot more like techie than you are. I'm like super techie nerd now and actually like love it. And what I really, really want to see technology do more is basically automate the paperwork and like automate the things that basically like don't add value to the relationship, right? So then I can spend more time with like the patients, and like I can spend more time with the other providers from other integrated systems, so I can learn more. Like imagine how much like we've learned from each other.
Oh yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's incredible.
Right. Yeah. And like these conversations, if it wouldn't have just like, you know, come across each other's paths, like I would have never even heard of craniosacral. And like imagine how much you can learn if, because you care about this patient sitting next to you, say if you have like a video chat with a specialist, how much you could learn in that just conversation. Right,
absolutely.
And then you can take that on and provide an even better service to the next person who walks in your door.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so I like to finish up my podcast, or start them one way or the other, with some of your daily health rituals. Also, maybe we'll start here. What is your definition of health?
Ooh, it's so funny because I feel like that's such a hard question. And this was in like part of why I wanted you to do this podcast to answer the question, because like for me, health is ... Like I have no idea for the most part, right? Because it's so individualized. And I can just at least say for myself and probably many other health providers out there and probably a lot of parents and stuff, like I do not take care of myself very well, right? Because I'm always like looking out for other people. And so really, like health is, for at least for me, like trying to like focus on myself. And I will tell you what I've learned in the last like 5 years, that if I can drink a gallon of fresh spring water a day, that is like the number one thing I can do for my health.
Yeah.
It has made probably like the biggest difference.
Yeah.
And like taking some time to be like outside in the sun, or just like outside in nature, to like ground myself. And like, cause I can get lost in my head really easily. And I think, you know, health often is just kind of like trying to be focus on you for a change in a positive way, maybe be a little grounded.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, I think you and I have done a lot of walks and conversations. I find it so much more stimulating in some ways, and also balancing in terms of, you know, having these kinds of conversations where there's a flow that happens when you're walking and moving. I know there's a lot more people who are doing these as business meetings, because we are now spending so much more time in one place with our head forward looking into a computer screen, you know, from a person who works with posture with people all the time. I can walk down any street and tell what people's jobs are now based on their posture. And it's huge for people to just get up and move around and do that. But I think, you know, what you have to say, I'm asking this question about your definition of health, because I struggle with really defining it for, you know, myself, but also for everyone that I'm working with. And my goal is to kind of collect, you know, more of this from people. I feel like I'm getting so many different kinds of answers. And even for myself, I feel like week to week, I could answer that question completely differently. And, you know, I still think there are some, you know, if we look at, you know, things like the Blue Zones Project, I think when you look at these people who have, you know, great numbers of centurions in their communities, we realize that probably the biggest thing is probably their relationships there. And it's kind of the things that we've been working on is, you know, how can you get that sense of support, you know, and we're all going to have health issues or, you know, mental issues or emotional challenges throughout the course of our lives. But to have this network and community around us is really the tricky part.
Oh my gosh. Absolutely.
Especially in a world where things are becoming more disjointed. It's not just health systems, but, you know, every aspect of our communities.
So. Totally. Because like on the face, it seems like we're more and more connected because of technology. But I would argue that it's actually done the opposite by basically making us more and more isolated, yeah. Right? And especially like in healthcare with like these systems that, I mean, doctors spend so much time like in front of like the computer screen and that sort of thing. And I think, again, if we can just spend more time together, I guess, outside, drinking yeah. water.
So would you be willing to come back here for another conversation?
Absolutely not. Of course.
We really did skim the surface today, knowing you as well as I do at this point. There are so many like small things that I've you know, seen you study and go through and have, you know, the information that you have on different kinds of things, like LDN and, I mean, just I can name a huge list. It'd be great to have you kind of go through some of those things. Maybe individually at some point and get some questions and maybe being one of the close people that I have in the medical community.
Absolutely.
If people are really curious to get some information about any given topic, to maybe be able to throw some questions in and have you come on once in a while. And,
oh yeah, that'd be awesome. I'd love to.
Cool. It'd be great. All right, man. Thanks for doing this.
Peace.
Dr. Aaron Babb, folks. I've met very few people over the years as a health professional as well-intentioned as that guy. He simply wants to help. But not only that, he just wants to be a good human being. This is why he spent the past 4 years pursuing ideas to improve the experience of care, not just for patients, but also for health professionals. He said to me early on, and I'm paraphrasing, "I love being a doctor, but doctors are some of the most unhealthy people I've ever met. And they have the highest suicide rate of all professionals. We need to have a place, a retreat center maybe, for doctors to get well again." While he was at Mayo, he was actually looking for land to purchase for exactly this cause. Yes, he's that kind of crazy, and I love him to death for it. Glad to finally get his story out there. Hope you enjoyed our conversation. I have a new email address for the podcast, jeremy@highwaytohealthpodcast.com. As always, I'd love to hear from you. Tell me what you think about the conversation, about the podcast. Let me know if there's someone you think I should have a conversation with. Until next time, take care of yourselves. Be kind to each other. Be good to your planet. Be well, my friends.